Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Let us learn from the Asian experience of when nukes go wrong. It isn't that much different from Three Mile Island or Chernobyl, what really happens. When it comes to government information to the bruised people of Japan, that doesn't come in time to help the survivors. After the first week of this disaster, the IAEA and the United States government pleaded for more information from the utility TEPCO and from the Japanese government. Starting March 19th, the Americans evacuated 200,000 personnel and their dependents in a mass air transit job. A government website gives the reason, quote, "Departure is authorized due to the deteriorating situation at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant following the 8.8 earthquake and tsunami," end quote. Almost a month later, we still find the Japanese government withholding information vital to the health and safety of citizens. Yomiuri Press complains, quote, "The Meteorological Agency has been withholding forecasts on dispersal of radioactive substances from the Fukushima No. 1 reactor power plant, despite making the forecasts every day. It was learned Monday." Here is NHK World TV from Japan, April 3rd.
Japan's government says it will withhold computer projections indicating high levels of radioactivity in areas more than 30 kilometers from the troubled Fukushima Daiichi power plant due to inaccurate data. An institute commissioned by the government made the estimates using a computer system called SPEEDY on March 16th after explosions at the plant. The system estimated that people who remained outdoors for 24 hours in Itate village, some 40 kilometers from the plant, would be exposed to radiation exceeding 100 millisieverts. The projections were based on the assumption that radioactive substances had been released for 24 hours on March 15th. The government's Nuclear Safety Commission says it did not release the projections because the locations or amount of radioactive leakage was not specified at the time.
The trend towards keeping the numbers down and the people pacified, if uninformed, runs at local governments as well. Ibaraki Prefecture, just south of Fukushima, has been heavily irradiated. In the city of Usiku, the local government did not tell residents when radioactive iodine topped the 100 becquerel per liter safety limits, reaching 124.9 on March 24th.
The Japanese Science and Technology Ministry says a cumulative radiation dose in Namie town topped 10 millisieverts in the 11-day period to Sunday. Namie is a little more than 30 kilometers from Fukushima Daiichi. Now, 10 millisieverts is the limit set by the government before ordering residents to stay indoors. The Nuclear Safety Commission says the limit has only been exceeded in a small area. It maintains the zone where residents should seek shelter inside doesn't need to be expanded.
Professor Masaharu Hoshi of Hiroshima University's Research Institute for Radiation Biology and Medicine says it's problematic that the state has not given an explanation to residents when the dose exceeds the state's target figure. He says the target figure is one criteria, so the government must decide what to do according to specific situations, but it must fulfill its responsibility to give an adequate explanation to residents. Chief Cabinet Secretary Yukio Edano says the government will wait for the results of the review of the evacuation zone and the indoor shelter zone before acting upon today's findings.
The Ministry of Education has touted their real-time radiation listings from the Nuclear Safety Division. I've checked that daily, and the most irradiated prefectures of Fukushima and nearby Miyagi are never listed. They always just say, under survey. The worst information is not released. A series of independent tests by Greenpeace radiologists and by representatives for the International Atomic Energy Agency have shown unsafe radiation in towns and cities well beyond the current evacuation zone, like cesium-137 40 kilometers away in Itate village and even up to 200 kilometers away. In some cases, the residents were not told to stay inside for their safety. The IAEA and the United States are pleading with the Japanese government to expand the evacuation zone to include another 170,000 people, but so far without result.
We're operating almost totally in the blind. Information is anything. The west mine is non-existent. I don't know, a couple of blind men now have to stay around making decisions.
The Japanese press do not use investigative reporting. Their traditional role is to repeat and explain what authorities, like the government and the utility company TEPCO, say at press briefings. Period. I have known Japanese NGOs who plead for information to be published in American newspapers, like the New York Times. Then and only then, the Japanese press will repeat what the foreign press said. There is hardly any way to originate a story in Japan beyond what authority says.
Less than 200 kilometers to the north lies Japan's capital, where the operator of the crippled Fukushima plant is coming under increasing pressure. A small crowd gathered outside the headquarters of the Tokyo Electric Power Company to voice their anger at its handling of the crisis. The protests seemed to go completely unnoticed by the Japanese media, but across the road there were plenty of other plain-clothed bystanders. They watched and filmed whoever turned up, but were camera-shy themselves. The Japanese journalists could be found inside the TEPCO building, waiting for the latest update from management. One reporter who wasn't there was Takashi Uesugi. He's a freelancer who's now out of work after he criticized TEPCO for mistakes made after the tsunami struck.
The Japanese mass media is basically sponsored by TEPCO through advertising. So far, nobody from the mass media has criticized TEPCO, only freelancers.
Wayne Hay, Al Jazeera, Hamaoka, Japan.
Advertisers controlling the press? Well, that could never happen here. And the nuclear industry rolls on, pushing even now for more and more reactors. The CEO of General Electric, Jeffrey Imhelt, Obama's advisor on how to send jobs overseas without ever paying taxes, was in Japan to boost confidence in the blown-up reactors his companies designed and helped build. At least, unlike poor muddle-headed George Monbiot, the Japanese media understands the role of the International Atomic Energy Agency. It's to sell more nuclear power, not to regulate it.
The head of the International Atomic Energy Agency says it will do its utmost to restore public trust in the safety of nuclear energy. The Convention on Nuclear Safety gathers once every 3 years with its 72 member nations and institutions. Director General Yukio Amano suggested the accident at the Fukushima Daiichi plant could affect the UN nuclear watchdog's future activities. The IAEA has been promoting nuclear power.
The situation at Fukushima Daiichi remains very serious. The worries of millions of people throughout the world about whether nuclear energy is safe must be taken seriously.
Amano expressed his determination to restore public trust through steps that include ministerial talks in June. The Japanese government and the IAEA will hold a special joint seminar during the meeting, which will run through April 14th. Officials of Japan's Nuclear and Industrial Safety Agency will also give a briefing on the latest details of the Fukushima situation.
And Russia, where AFP reports Fukushima radioactive particles were detected in Moscow on April 1st, and where the far eastern seaboard around Vladivostok may get both wind and ocean-borne radioactivity, Russia is still out there selling nuclear power plants to any buyer, anywhere. Here's an update from NHK World on the Russian reactor market.
In April 1984, the world's worst ever nuclear accident took place at the Chernobyl nuclear power plant in the Ukraine, then part of the Soviet Union. The disaster prompted the Soviet government to cancel plans to build more nuclear plants. But when Vladimir Putin became president of Russia in 2000, he made a major policy shift and began promoting nuclear energy to meet the needs of the country's rapidly growing economy. It was a low-cost power generation solution for Russia, which has easy access to uranium sourced domestically and from other countries of the former Soviet Union.
As people's standard of living improves, there's growing demand for electricity. We have to provide more electricity not only during the winter, when we have to use heaters, but also in summer, because more and more people now have air conditioners in their homes.
The Russian government sees atomic power as a key to its economic growth and is promoting nuclear technology exports. In the past 10 years, Russia has won contracts in five countries, including China and India, to build a total of 13 nuclear plants and provide them with fuel. Nuclear energy is one of the few industries where Russia has a competitive edge in the global market. 4 days after the accident in Fukushima, Putin, now Russia's prime minister, visited Belarus and agreed to help that country build new nuclear power plants. Then on March 16th, Russian President Dmitry Medvedev met Turkish Prime Minister Recep Erdogan in Moscow and promised that Russia will continue to help Turkey with its nuclear power development program. Russia has made it clear that it will continue to push hard to win contracts for building nuclear plants abroad, while keeping an eye on how the events at Fukushima affect the rest of the world.
Australia's green economist Ross Garnaut says nuclear is still the way to go, at least for valuable uranium exports for that country. The whole nuclear military-industrial complex, with all the talking heads of state, are whirling around the world reassuring everyone. French President Nicolas Sarkozy went straight to Japan. Obama still wants $36 billion for the nuclear industry. Now we see who these politicians really work for. And strangely, the machines and regulations that monitor and protect the population are being pulled back, even in this time of atomic emergency. Early press reports said the American Environmental Protection Agency withdrew 20 monitors because readings were too high. The agency later clarified that these radiation monitors, part of RadNet, weren't working properly. That included 4 out of 11 monitoring machines in California, where 2 nuclear power plants sit near earthquake faults. In fact, the federal government didn't release any radioactivity report until Tuesday, April 5th, 25 days after one of the world's largest nuclear disasters. That's some early warning system. We only found out there was radiation landing in the U.S. Northeast because it was reported by a nuclear power plant operator. The University of California, Berkeley in San Francisco reported rainwater testing many times the safe level of iodine-131 during heavy rains on March 23rd. The site has now been retrofitted, saying rainwater doesn't count, only tap water should be considered, and that was safe. Let's talk with another university that measured Fukushima radiation on the West Coast.
Radio EcoShock.
Our guest now is Christoph Starosta, known as Chris, I guess, an associate professor at Simon Fraser University in Canada. Chris, how did Simon Fraser University find emissions from the Fukushima disaster?
So after we learned about the Fukushima accident, we decided to set up a monitoring system for the rainwater. So we set up a collecting station where we collected water whenever it was raining. And we have at Simon Fraser a germanium detector in the lead shield for environmental studies. So that was the tool which we used to identify gamma rays from the emission of emitted after the decay of radioiodine, the isotope of iodine called iodine-131. This is a man-made isotope. It does not exist in the atmosphere under normal conditions. It has a half-life of 8 days. So whenever you have a release, within a couple of weeks, iodine-131 decays completely and it's absent from the atmosphere. So we started to monitor the rainwater and search for the signature of iodine-131, and we didn't see anything until March 18th, and then on March 19th and on March 20th, we've seen a spike, which indicated the presence of iodine-131, and then we decided to verify these findings by examining another samples. And we knew that seaweed is a marine plant which accumulates iodine, so we decided to monitor also seaweed. And we've seen the same signal in the seaweed, and we collected seaweed from 2 different places, from Vancouver Island and from North Vancouver. So rainwater and seaweed from both places showed a consistent signal associated with the presence of iodine-131, so we concluded that this must be a release from Fukushima.
Now, the city of Vancouver draws on water from open reservoirs, and we presume rainwater would go in there. Is there any risk currently to the drinking water for the city?
I don't think so. We have been monitoring the content of iodine-131 in the rainwater whenever we had a possibility to collect samples. There were a couple of clear days where we were not able to collect the rainwater, but we've seen, I described the increase on the March 19th and 20th. We've seen plateau after that, which extended until March 25th. And then starting from March 25th, we've seen a decline in the rate of iodine-131. And as of yesterday, our samples show essentially no presence in iodine-131 in the rainwater. And even the amounts which we have seen in the rainwater were really tiny. We've seen amounts of 12 becquerels per liter. 12 becquerels means 12 decays per second per liter of water. And if you take into account the fact that the water, rainwater with containing iodine-131 would be diluted in the reservoirs which were holding water before Fukushima, the amount which would end up in the drinking water is really tiny.
And that's what I've heard from Environment Canada as well. So far, there's no reason to panic about that. But do we have a way of measuring, for example, the cesium-137 that might be arriving?
We are sensitive to cesium-137. So cesium-137 has a gamma ray, which we could see. I think that the answer to that is that the first thing you would see is iodine-131, and that's the reason we observe iodine-131. And the reason is that cesium-137 has much longer lifetime and is much harder to detect. It requires longer measurements. On the other hand, iodine-131 has shorter lifetimes. It's more active, and it decays more. Therefore, it's easier to spot it. And cesium and iodine would be released into atmospheric releases. Both, I think, will go together. So the first thing to watch for, I think, is iodine-131. We are saving the samples, so the samples which we collected are saved, and we are going to look for cesium-137 when the things are going to calm down and we have more time to spend on prolonged measurements. So the samples which we are saving right now will preserve cesium-137, so we'll be able to go back in time and assess the levels of cesium-137.
And the reason I asked about that is because it is a longer-lasting radiative material and so perhaps more serious if it is arriving, and I guess the answer is we don't know yet.
I wouldn't. Yeah, I mean, the question is, of course, what we don't know is we don't know the quantities. And I think that probably the people who measure with, let's say, can have more detectors to measure different kinds of radioactivity simultaneously, they probably know. We at Simon Fraser, we don't know it because we have only one measuring station and we have to manage the measurements with single measuring station. So if we measure iodine-131, we cannot measure cesium-137. Essentially, because we cannot afford the time to do these measurements. But I think that there are other governmental agencies which are not limited in this way, and they can. I think that I will be careful in concluding that we don't know. I think that it's probably known, and it certainly can be assessed in the future from the measurements of the samples which were preserved.
Well, I guess the thing that concerns me is that we haven't had a report from the Canadian government that I'm aware of whether cesium-137 is arriving here or not. I just haven't seen any reporting on it.
Oh, I haven't seen them either, but that's probably because I didn't look carefully enough. But I think that I can tell you that in our measurements, which are targeted towards iodine-131, we don't see an increase of cesium-137. And one thing about cesium-137, which we need to remember, is that there were on the order of 2,000 atmospheric tests of nuclear weapon before the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty was signed. And cesium-137 has been emitted from, there was probably on the order of 550 atmospheric tests. And the cesium-137, which was dispersed from these tests in the 60s and 50s and 60s, is still around us because of the fact that it has 30 years lifetime. So we actually do see cesium-137 in our spectra, in our measurement, and I can measure the intensity of cesium-137. So I should maybe be more precise. I don't see any changes in the cesium-137. I do see cesium-137, but the fact that it's not changing is, for me, indicative that this is a cesium-137 which is not related to Fukushima. It's the constant cesium-137 which is present in the atmosphere from the previous releases, for example, nuclear weapon tests.
Thank you. I find that a good explanation. There's one other thing, if you could help me with this, and if you can't, just go ahead and say so. But there's a fellow named Chris Busby in the United Kingdom who has been critical of the ICRP model, which he says measures full body exposure to external emissions, whereas what we need to be concerned about is internal inhalation or ingestion of radioactive particles. Or certainly that's what the Japanese need to be concerned about. Have you heard about this controversy, and are you comfortable with the safety measures set by the authorities so far?
Well, I think I'm certainly aware of the controversy because it's a well-known controversy, and I think that the difficulty in dealing with the situations like that is that there are no good data on the low-level exposures. So we are talking right now about exposure to low levels of radioactivity. If in this situation, it is very difficult to assess the impact of the radioactivity or disentangle the impact of the radioactivity of other sources which can contribute, for example, to the increased chance of cancer, right? So if somebody is smoking cigarettes and inhaling radioactivity, it's difficult to assess what is the impact of one in the presence or absence of the other because the low exposures inherently have a difficulty in being quantified. I think that, having said that, I'm not a doctor. I don't have a degree in medicine, and I haven't studied that. We measure radiation, and we report simply the radiation levels. I think that with the risk assessment, you need to be always careful because you can actually taking preventive measures against imaginary risk. You can actually do more harm than good. And one way to compare is compare the situation which we have right now is to compare to other incidents. And there is data available on other incidents. So, for example, when we were doing our studies here in the rainwater, we looked up the literature and we've seen papers coming from Japan, from Nagoya, Japan in 1988, where people were studying the levels of iodine-131 in the rainwater following the Chernobyl explosion. And this were iodine-131, which was showing up in Nagoya, Japan after the Chernobyl. And they were reporting levels four times higher than we have seen in the rainwater. So as we were reporting 10 becquerels or 11, 12 becquerels per liter, they were showing 40, 44 and more. And this study, which is published in a medical journal, Health Physics, it actually concluded that there was no impact on the population. This is one of our reference points. I think that this controversy is not going to be resolved anytime soon. I think the reason is that that there is no data, essentially. I think that if you ask me about my comment on that, I would say that we always need to compare to the levels of the background in which we live, the environmental background levels. And we as humans were evolving in the presence of radiation. Radiation was always around us. And radiation is going to stay with us. There are sources, natural sources of radiation, which is crust of the Earth and the cosmic background. And these sources of radiation are always with us. And when we talk about the levels of exposures, which are small, comparable to the natural doses which we receive, if there was really a harm of these small doses, it would probably lead to an extinction of our human race long time ago.
But I have to say, as you've pointed out, Dr. Starosta, that the atomic testing did introduce new types of elements onto the Earth that
sure.
had never existed
yeah.
before during Absolutely. Our evolution
yeah.
and raised the level of radioactivity. And here we have another situation where it appears like we're going to be adding more radioactivity than the background would have been there during our evolution. I think we've got to wrap up now. Is there any closing comments you'd like to make?
Yeah, I think I would say that if you measure these quantities of man-made elements compared to other, they're small.
Very good. Thank you for your opinion. And this is Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock. We've been talking with Chris Starosta, the associate professor at Simon Fraser University in Canada. Thank you. As one contributor to theoildrum.com noted, it's like the nuclear information lights are going out all over the world. Canada's Natural Resources Agency has put the following on its reporting webpage, quote, "Please note that as of March 25, 2011, the frequency of data collection by the NRC-CAN using the mobile surveys has been decreased due to the low levels of radiation being detected. The surveys will be repeated periodically and the data table will be updated, end quote. And both the US EPA and the European Union are currently moving the safe level of radiation upwards as Fukushima rages out of control. The EPA Protective Action Guides, or PAGs, have been revised upwards for iodine-131 and other radioactive materials, allowing thousands of times more. The group Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility, or PEER, has exposed these changes. In Europe, a series of foreign language sources report the European Union has quietly, without public input, raised the permissible levels on a number of radioactive substances in an emergency ordinance number 297/2011 on March 27th. This includes allowing higher radioactivity in foods and herbal products just in time for the new round of radiation. Isn't the government supposed to protect us? Nuclear critics like Chris Busby and Helen Caldicott and some nuclear scientists have been saying the allowable limits for safety are a cruel joke anyway. The whole regime of what is supposedly safe exposure was based on a physics calculation where external radiation is measured as a full-body dose, considering the human body like a big sack of water. Listen to a full explanation by Chris Busby in the Politics and Science podcast, as posted April 2nd on www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the number, forall.net. Or find that link in my blog. In fact, that program, Politics and Science, has a whole list of essential nuclear listening shows on low-level radiation. Like Dr. Starosta, not all scientists agree with Busby's assessment, but it makes sense to me. Check the sources and decide for yourself. In fact, as you heard in our Radio EcoShock interview with Dr. Caldicott 2 weeks ago, the real threat comes from radioactive particles that are inhaled or eaten with food. Be sure and listen to Helen Caldicott's weekly radio show, If You Love This Planet, at ifyoulovethisplanet.org. This week, she has a special Fukushima update, and that will likely continue in coming programs. Once lodged in the body, particles like plutonium and other radioactive heavy metals impact the DNA in just a small part of the body very intensely. The damage ricochets into cancer and other diseases brought on by damaged chromosomes. Detailed studies of cancers and other diseases near nuclear power plants and following famous nuclear accidents, not to mention the atomic testing downwinders and those poor people in Iraq who suffer from spent uranium weapons, all show that particles within the body bring on disease at levels many times lower and many times greater than the published safety limits would tell you. Those were derived in the 1950s before DNA was even discovered. We stick with the outdated science at our peril and as a convenience for both the nuclear power industry and the governments who support them. If we, the public, learn only one thing from this Fukushima accident, it must be the need for new and fair regulations governing doses of radiation at low levels and the cumulative dose. And that, says Chris Busby, would mean a speedy end to the nuclear power industry. Look and learn for yourself. The authorities will not warn or protect you in time. That is the true and sad lesson taught by both climate change and nuclear technology. Fukushima is the schoolhouse, and a harsh one, for Japan, for us all. I'm Alex Smith. Our show blog is at ecoshock.info. The main website is ecoshock.org. Find us on 25 college and community radio stations, by podcast, and live by satellite. Thank you for hanging in through this awful time, and join us next week for Radio EcoShock.
And thanks to all the listeners from all over the world who sent in those hot tips and links about this nuclear story. Couldn't do it without you. Keep them coming. Radio@ecoshock.org.